Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist, where your special education questions meet expert answers. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor, a certified educational therapist, special educator, and your go-to special ed strategist. Here to collaborate with families to access special education services, ignite student potential, and erase learning gaps. Together, we'll unlock the services and support your kiddos' needs to thrive. Let's get started. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com. Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist. I am looking forward to our conversation today. We are talking about bullying, and I have my guest here. I'm going to have her introduce herself to you guys, and then we're going to dive in with our conversation. So, Christine, welcome, and please just give us a little introduction about who you are and how you got here.
Thank you so much, Wendy. I'm Christine Wanders, and I'm a psychologist in the Philadelphia area. I started working in the kind of bullying realm quite a few years ago at CHOP, helping to develop interventions for the classroom or for small groups where we could help kids learn skills that would reduce aggression and bullying. And that has morphed into a nice role for me at Children's Hospital, where I am offering consultation and training around the issue of bullying to clinicians and doctors, and also do this in the community a bit as well, which is, I think, how you found me.
It is. And it's so needed. And I love that you get in the classroom, but you also are doing work with families as well through Children's. And Children's has a special place in my heart. So it goes out to you for that and the work that you're doing. Before we get started, I always like to ask my guest a question as to what is something that's little known to the folks that you work with that's not necessarily related to what you do in your position.
Sure. Well, this is on my mind because we are heading to the Netherlands soon. And you might be able to tell from my last name and the two A's that I come from a Dutch background, and I do speak some Dutch. So that is a skill that's not often called on, but something I really enjoy. So
I love it. I love it. I love it. So let's kind of go back to bullying. Can you help set the stage? Can you share one statistic on the prevalence of bullying among neurodivergent students in particular, or how is that compared to neurotypical peers?
Sure. Yeah. So how we ask this question in the research affects what kinds of numbers we see. But when you look across many different studies, it seems the consensus is that about 28 or 30% of kids experience bullying. When we look at kids with developmental differences or mental health differences, that number rises more into the 40s. Yeah, so we see also that the numbers are highest in middle school, which may fit with many people's memories of middle school. That is a tough time socially, and that is generally when bullying peaks.
So what does that tell us about the challenges that are faced by our students, either neurotypical or neurodivergent?
Well, I mean, I think you can consider the developmental level of your neurodivergent child, right? So they may be more at a middle school level in high school. And so they may be engaging in some of this behavior themselves, you know, picking on other kids a little bit longer maybe than some of their peers. So that would be something to think about. But also just that's the time for parents to really be on high alert, I think, to look for those social difficulties and just be checking in with your child to hear, are other kids, you know, being kind and respectful? There's different ways you can ask, but that's the time to look out for it.
So what are some things that parents could say, or kind of what are some key signs or behaviors that both parents and educators can look out for to help kind of identify if a child is being bullied or the reverse, if they are bullying?
I think that we really have to get creative in how we ask our kids this question, because kids, especially maybe kids on the autism spectrum, really experience these questions as a demand. And they are not thrilled that you're questioning them all about their school day, right? They may not be very forthcoming. So I think I just encourage parents to get creative. So doing a little bit more sort of declarative language is an approach that I've seen where you might say it as a statement. You know, middle school can be a time when a lot of kids are mean to each other. And then you could just sort of let that sit there and see what comes back to you. Or you could move into a question and say, has anything happened to you that was upsetting, like bullying or even just getting frustrated with your friends, you know, and try to make it sound very typical and very normal when you're asking about it.
And what are some other ways that we could ask or kind of maybe look at body language or really just try to figure it out? Because even if we make that statement,
yeah,
sometimes it just sits there and hangs in the air without a response. So how can we kind of, like you said, put it in a way, frame it in a way that we're building this rapport with either our student or our personal student or students that we support, that they will then share that information with us?
I think the signs that you would be looking for are similar to signs of depression and anxiety and stress. So you would want to see, is there an increase in irritability, maybe more crying and melting down after school, maybe more school avoidance, complaints in the morning about not wanting to go. They can just be related to the demands of the classroom, but they're often related to the social, just dreading this long day of social interaction and not knowing what's coming, especially if they're being picked on in one of their classes. So I think looking for those general signs of distress, and then if your child is not directly sharing with you, really turning to your team at school and asking them to keep an eye out and maybe a closer watch to see socially what's going on.
And so how can we then empower, you know, we're having the conversations, but how can we empower our students to recognize and respond to bullying that can be safe and effective? Because that's, you know, it could be happening, but then how are they going to be able to navigate that?
Right. And that's not a simple, I don't have a simple answer. I think it's multi-pronged. So I think it's really important to start early with your kids, maybe even role-playing kind of how to handle hard social situations. Because if you have begun doing that before anything bad happened, then it's easy to extend that into a time where we're problem-solving something that's more challenging. So I think, you know, thinking of yourself a little bit like a therapist for your kid in this regard, because they're more relaxed with you and more willing to maybe do some role play. I think too, some kids really need us to give them some scripts. And that can even be part of an IEP process where we lay out some maybe missing skills and how we want the team to address those gaps or those lagging skills in terms of, you know, if a child is mean to you, what are some things you could do? What are some things you could say? And because it can be hard for kids with social delays to determine whether a kid is doing playful teasing or mean teasing or actual bullying, really teaching them to talk this over with adults, because I think it's hard for any of us sometimes to figure out other people's intentions. So I always work with kids on trying to remember, you know, we need to really look for evidence that they were being mean, you know, and not assume, because some kids jump right to that kid's bullying me, when in fact it's maybe, you know, for some kids, that's not the case. They are being annoying, but you two have equal amounts of power, and sometimes you annoy them. So that means that you have more of an equal relationship rather than a bully and victim relationship. So there are so many facets of this that we want to help kids with. So I think the best thing is to just teach them to go to adults to talk it through, because they're going to need that support interpreting other kids' intentions.
Then how do we train adults that they can just do what you just did in terms of like knowing that there's these lagging social skills and then helping a child understand what level it comes in and helping them process that information?
I think this is really important, because I think a lot of adults go to is to say to kids, just ignore it, just brush it off, just ignore it. And that is certainly sometimes the best thing to do, but to just give that as blanket advice it's really not sufficient. And also kind of impossible for kids who have poor impulse control. They're not good at ignoring stuff. And so I think they should probably sit down and get realistic about this child's set of skills and abilities and what they might be able to do in a hard situation and really think it through before they start to give advice to that child or design, you know, some IEP goals and SDIs. I just want them to be thoughtful about it. You know, that's kind of the most important thing. I don't know where to send people really for training on this. But I think also I want to say that schools need to be addressing these issues all the time. And so each school should have some social and emotional learning programming where the teachers are working with the kids on developing their vocabulary for handling conflicts and friendship issues. And then anybody on the special ed team can learn that as well. And, you know, adopt the same vocabulary and the same coping skills and help the kids who need a little more explicit help to learn those. So sometimes there's a program in place already at the school that teachers can make use of.
In your experience with IEPs, have you seen or can you make any recommendations of wording, kind of the wording that would be placed into an IEP or the staff training that you can request within an IEP that you have seen be successful that a parent that is listening could then take that with them to their next team meeting?
Well, one thing I will say is as a consultant, I don't always get to hear back the final results. So I think this is hard to make it really successful, but I definitely have, you know, some wording that people could ask for. I think it should be about, so we need to help the child and the family understand that we're not blaming them for the victimization. However, we do want them to have skills for coping with those hard situations. And so I think it would be written in as working on social problem solving and developing phrases. You could actually say that the child will develop sort of coping phrases to use when someone is mean to them. They will practice with their, you know, special ed teacher or the school counselor how to respond and who to go to when someone is mean. So I think putting in sort of that safety plan, putting that in writing, and then the way that you include it in the IEP is to say, we want the child to learn this safety plan and who to go to. Those are a couple of ideas. Now, sometimes the reason a child is being targeted is because of some of their symptoms, right? Of ADHD or autism or anxiety. They get very maybe agitated when another kid is starting to be mean to them. And so that's another thing that could be worked on. Again, it's very tricky. You don't want them to feel that you're saying this is their fault. But if we can teach them to sort of calm themselves a little bit more before they try to handle the situation, that can really go a long way. So that's another thing that could be included in the IEP.
Let's talk a little bit about that safety plan. What does that mean and who kind of develops that and where would that come into play?
I feel like this is one of my most important roles as I go around talking to different groups. I think parents need to know that they can use that phrase and say, I would like to request a safety plan for my child, because not a lot of schools are telling people they can ask for that. And so it doesn't need to be, you know, there are templates that you can find online if you'd like some support with it, but it can be as simple as establishing in an email what the changes are going to be to keep your child safe. And we want the school to acknowledge that they need to keep your child safe and not just sort of shake their heads and say, oh, we tried, you know, but this keeps happening. And that's where you try to get it in writing. So I think a safety plan should include things like looking at the child's seating in the classroom, whether they just need to be moved away from a certain peer or closer to the teacher. When it's quite serious, the aggressive kid should be moved out of that class if possible, or there just needs to be extra supervision on that kid to make sure they're not doing this to our child that we're concerned about or any other child. And then also looking at maybe vulnerable places and times in the school day. So is this happening more when the child goes to the bathroom? Is this happening more at recess or lunch? If so, how can we get some extra protection at those times? And then a third piece that I think is important is having a built-in check-in time for the child to go see a supportive special ed teacher or counselor or administrator, whoever the child feels comfortable with, where they're just checking in about anything that's been hard, so that if it happens, they don't have to sort of ask to go speak to someone.
And that is great. And kind of as you're saying this, I'm kind of using my IEP coaching brain and just the years that I've worked in school systems, something that's been effective that folks can also use is check in, check out. So very similar to what you're saying, but they come into the building, they go into that particular teacher. And then there's also a protocol put in place so that if that person, so if I'm that point person, the student can come to me, but for some reason, if I'm out of the building for that day, whether an illness or training or something, that it is communicated to the child and that there's a plan B, so to say, person that they can connect with. So it's just, and it worked really well, checking in, how did the night go? What are we working on? What do we need? And then at the end of the day, the reverse of that. And even if it's just having that conversation and touching base, but also, you know, do you have what you need to bring home? What are we working on tonight? So just that, and it doesn't have to be some long drawn out thing. I've been on hallway duty with my cup of coffee and somebody comes and we just have a quick check-in, but it's really helpful for our kiddos to do that. And then the other thing that kind of came to mind as you were talking about a safety plan for parents, when you go to your IEP meeting, there's a section in the IEP for your parent input statement. And we always say, you know, looking at kind of where your child is now and where you see your child, so you can start to build that forward thinking of building supports through the IEP for your kiddo to be success. And you can write information in there as a parent and make sure that it gets put in that IEP before the IEP is officially closed, meaning that it's, if it's in a system, that it's closed down. And then also you can request in an IEP for training, staff training, so that that can take place for whatever that may look like, whether it's developing that safety plan, whether it's the verbiage of kind of what you were talking about, trying to identify with a student, whether it's, you know, is this bullying? Is this, you know, equal? Is this, you know, how did you phrase that one more time? Just to kind of, to help a team and a student kind of delineate where this is.
Right. I think it would be teaching the child to distinguish between more everyday conflicts and annoying behavior versus bullying or harassment, you know, and hopefully we'll get to this. But I think parents need to know as well that when a child with an IEP is being harassed and it's related to their disability, there are extra things the school needs to do to keep them safe. And so usually the administration is especially responsive in those cases.
So how have you seen parents and professionals working together to help support this student or to build that resilience, whether it's through their IEP, through their school day?
I think, as I said before, I don't always get to sort of see the outcomes of my consultation, but I think the best thing is when, and maybe I'm thinking more of elementary school, when there's maybe a little bit more back and forth with the special ed teacher, where there's some, every other week or so, there's some kind of a check-in by email or a phone call now and then. But I know that can be a burden for the teachers, but especially if we have a child that's going through some hard things for this phase, you know, it's really important to share with the parent the messaging that they're giving, the school is giving the child about how to handle these things. So then the parent can also kind of explore that further in the evenings and, you know, reinforce those recommendations about how kids handle things. So I guess just that regular contact.
When do you recommend a parent kind of reach out to you? At what level would a parent kind of connect with a professional in your role? And then how can they utilize the school mental health professionals kind of to provide this support?
Yeah, I think it's always a great idea to start with the school mental health folks. But some kids hate to miss class, right? And so some kids love to miss class, some kids hate to miss class. So they may not always want that extra sort of pullout time in their week. But what I'm always envious of the school mental health professionals is that they know the setting so well. They know the kids, they know positive peers they might be able to connect your child with. So I think there's a lot of good reasons to start with the school mental health professionals. And then when I would really want people to reach out to a therapist is when they're seeing signs of ongoing anxiety and depression. It's not just occasional, you know, where it's becoming almost a daily situation. That's showing us that this child is feeling hopeless, trapped in this situation, very stressed by it. And so then you want to set up time with a therapist so that the child gets that extra support and validation. And also, you know, really somebody focusing on those coping skills and helping the child not to feel so trapped by this experience.
How do you talk to a parent that their kiddo has been successful, say, in elementary school, right? And their social skills seem to align with the kiddos. And then kind of like you said, they transition to middle school or transition to high school. And then that's really where those lagging skills kind of come to the surface. How mm-hmm. do you help the parent start to identify that or support the parent and then communicating that to other folks? And supporting the student, I should say, first.
I think that I try to help families understand that middle school is a time where maybe we start to see that divergence a little bit more because social skills get more complex and social interactions get more complex in middle school. Also, middle school is a time when kids really hone in on differences and pressure each other to all be the same, all wear the same things, all like the same things. There's intense pressure in that regard. And so I think it's important to know that this is a very typical experience for all of the kids in middle school. They're all feeling that pressure and all needing to kind of up their game in terms of how they're interacting. And so to really anticipate that even if your child did do pretty well and was fairly well integrated in elementary school, it's pretty likely to change in middle school if you have a kid with some social skills impairment. And so I think a great way to be ready for that is to try to get your child involved in activities and groups outside of school where they can really have supportive peers. Maybe some kids who have a common interest with them. There are a lot of scout troops that are very welcoming, different kinds of youth groups that are welcoming. And as well as maybe if your child has a special interest or hobby, to really support that because they're going to need it in middle school. They're going to need to know that even if I had a hard school day, I have these friends outside of school who really get me. And then one other thing I want to say about that is I think that we're all, as parents, so worried about our kids' time online. But I think that for kids who are a little bit different, finding like-minded peers online is very healthy and supportive. So there are a lot of ways that they do that. You know, it could be through a video game community, but other online kind of interest groups as well. And so, you know, they may, again, have that hard day at school, but can get a little bit of refuge and support from their online connections.
Have you seen peer mentoring or kind of a buddy system play a supportive role in this process?
I don't have direct experience with it. And I think it's kind of hard in middle school.
Yeah.
I think like on both sides, I don't know how well, I think it has to be done in a sneaky way.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like we have to kind of try to push some kids together without being too explicit about it, or yeah, maybe giving kids purposely putting kids together for what's it called? Partner work in the classroom, you know, making sure that a kid who's got some vulnerabilities is with one of those pro-social kids, things like that. I think that that works best for kids maybe who are more impaired and not as socially aware, ironically, right? That would be a better time to have a buddy system and they might embrace it a little bit more, which also I wanted to bring up an interesting finding or something that I've learned recently that I wasn't aware of. And I don't know the exact figure, but there's evidence that kids who are mainstreamed, so kids maybe on the spectrum who are spending much of their day in mainstream classrooms, experience more bullying than kids who are maybe spending more of their time in pullout kind of educational settings. So I I think that's concerning, isn't it? Like, we have such a push for inclusion, but that's maybe putting kids in hard situations.
And I think that's a great perspective. How do we know kind of the balance with that when we're advocating at the table, at an IEP table? How can we kind of help? And it is individualized, right, for each student. So how can we kind of help figure out what would work best for that individual student's needs or to support their social skills in terms of pull out versus mainstream?
Well, I'm concerned that it's such a strong national trend that it's kind of not so individualized when we get in the IEP room. I mean, there's such a push to just have everybody be kind of in the mainstream classroom. So, you know, given that understanding, I think that maybe the best that you can do is ask for some time in the day when they get that pullout experience. And it may not come until you have had some negative experiences and you're wanting them to make a change, to give your child that break in the day, time when they can just be with other kids that they're relaxed around. And I know that happens in the high school setting in my district, that, you know, there's this time when the kids get together kind of it's kind of like a support group for the kids in special ed to just kind of be together and talk about what's hard. And so I hope that we can, ask for that more, raise everybody's awareness that, you know, inclusion is great in a lot of ways, but we have to look at the stresses of it as well. And maybe that's where we need more training for the classroom teachers. Training and resources, right? I mean, they're asked to include a whole range of kids in their classes. And do they have the training to do that and to look out for, you know, kids who are being teased because of their differences? And what can they do about it?
And that brings up a great point, just coming from your lens as a clinical psychologist in terms of identifying the social stressors that a child may be experiencing. And that can be really hard though, right? Because you have some students that mask as well, and they're trying to kind of hold everything together. And then that's really challenging as well.
That's right. And I think it is unfair to ask a classroom teacher to try to dig in and figure out if a kid who's masking is actually very distressed. Like, that's a lot to ask, you know? So, but I do think it's important for them to be aware of masking, because I've had a lot of families be frustrated with the teacher saying, "I'm not seeing any of that at school," sort of questioning, is that anxiety therefore real? You know, so I think you're reminding me that is something I've been concerned about. So the teacher doesn't need to always dig and get to the bottom of everything, but just to be aware that there may be masking going on so that the child maybe may need to be sent to see the counselor. If you're suspecting there's some stress going on and they haven't asked, you could still suggest it, you know. I guess what I picture ideally happening is that the teacher would notice, and I think they do notice, when kids are being left out a lot. Whether it's being done in a mean way, which would be more obvious, or whether it's just happening, these kids are kind of neglected peers. People aren't just turning to them and talking to them or inviting them to be a part of an interaction. And I would hope then the teacher would kind of maybe go behind the scenes to one of their most pro-social kids and just suggest that maybe they could try to include this kid a little bit more. Another way is for the teacher right in front of everybody to show that this kid has humor, this kid has some fun things to offer by their own interactions with that kid and modeling that in front of everybody. So trying to bring the best out of that student would make them more appealing than to their peers.
There's such a power in modeling, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If a parent wants to advocate at a community level to address bullying, what are some ways that parents can mobilize their communities to better support neurodivergent children or students that are experiencing bullying?
I think it's wonderful when parents, you know, learn what programming is happening at the school and then ask for more. I think every school should have some sort of an anti-bullying approach, you know. A lot of schools now have social and emotional learning programs like Second Step, for example, is one of them. But they don't always address bullying. And so making sure that is being addressed specifically. And I can offer some names of programs if you want to include those as links. But I think a really good way to be heard on this topic is if you join sort of the special ed committee at your school. I don't know if every school has that, Wendy, and maybe you can actually speak to that, but I know that in our district, there's a whole committee for parents of kids in special ed, and they offer workshops for parents, and together they have a voice with the administration. And so that would be a great way to sort of highlight maybe some gaps that they see in the programming. And if there isn't that, just through your parent teacher association, you know, your homeschool association, definitely would be a great way to sort of lift up these concerns and just to say we're not critiquing the school and saying this school is unusually bad in this area. We think every school needs this because it's a very common concern. So
yeah, and to your question, yes. Yeah, so depending on the school and the district, some schools do have a parent special ed committee and some are district wide, but either there will be one typically for a parent, whether it's at their homeschool or in their district. It just depends on how it's set up. But I think that's a great way to start looking for trainings and also finding folks that may be in the same situation that you are with the same similar concerns so that you can have a dialogue and bridging those resources and communicating and supporting not only your kiddo, but the other kiddos in the school building.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you are in an area where there's a university, often there are, or like Children's Hospital, for example, there are, you know, researchers and leaders in various fields who would be happy to partner with your school to, you know, share with them what are some of the best practices, what are some of the best programs. So I think whenever those relationships can happen, that's really beneficial. And I know we want them on the institutional side. So I think if families and schools can remember that and reach out to their local kind of institutions, we can support with some of this.
Do you recommend a certain, like call the clinical psychology unit, or just start with the institution as a whole?
So I guess if it was a university, maybe looking at the education department and trying to email some folks there, or the psychology. Yeah, the psychology program to see what they may be doing. A public health is another field where they're often looking to partner with institutions. Those would be kind of the three types of departments I would look at. And then hospitals now, like Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, have violence prevention programming. And so we have a whole, it's not quite a department, but it's like a center at CHOP, the Center for Violence Prevention that I'm a part of. And so we are often, you know, doing community outreach, creating programs to try to address the aggression that kids are experiencing.
As a parent that is navigating this world of special education and IEPs and neurodivergence and, you know, social skills and propensity for bullying or if active bullying, what are some of your recommendations for kind of the parent for respite for themselves or mental health self-care for themselves as the adult?
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh, I mean, I think that is such a good question and a good thing to bring up because I think sometimes it's hard to come by, right? So I really see a lot of people getting support on, there's a really active Facebook group in the Philadelphia region for parents of kids with special needs. And I think people seem to get so much support just from sharing their experiences there and feeling less alone. Not only do they get specific suggestions of resources, but also they just get people to say, I see you and what you're doing is amazing and it's really hard. Sometimes they offer to babysit for each other and support each other. So I think maybe also using that local or, you know, school district special ed parent group to try to meet other parents of kids with special needs so that you know that you can schedule some play dates with a family who is really not going to be judgmental about your kid. You know, I think that can be so hard and can make families feel isolated if they feel like they can't leave their kid with a typical babysitter or they can't have a regular play date. I think of those things as adding a lot of stress for parents. So I guess that's my first recommendation, is looking for that peer support with other parents going through something similar. In terms of the other kinds of respite, take resources, don't they? I mean, you have to either tag team with your partner and really maybe identify, you know, one day or evening a month, you're going to go do something that's just for you. And then the other thing is just, if that's impossible, finding 10 or 15 minutes a day for you to do self-care. So ways that can just fit into your regular day, whether it's mindfulness, journaling, drinking tea and looking out the window. So
I'm a big walker. I like to do that. It helps clear my mind.
Yeah, it gets that nervous energy out sometimes. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah,
I'll walk up with a cup of water, and then I'll walk back with a cup of coffee, and
yeah,
I was right. So if you had kind of a magic wand to help parents prioritize, right? So if they're saying, my kiddo is being bullied, what should I do? What would your recommendations be for helping them prioritize what to do first?
I think that's easy, and it should be easy for parents. The number one thing is to provide emotional support and a listening ear, right? So we want to validate their experience. We want to just say, that sounds so upsetting, and that shouldn't have happened to you. That's not right what happened. And I am so sorry that you are experiencing that, right? So just remembering how far that goes, because sometimes we jump right to anger at the situation or irritation or what are we going to do about this? And who am I going to call? But I want everybody to slow down and slow down and just be with your child. And that's like half of it, you know? Really giving them that support, because we can't always control what's going to happen at school, but we can control what we do at home. So then next would be thinking through how you want to approach this at the school and who your supportive people are at the school. Are you going to start with their classroom teacher? Are you going to start with their special ed teacher? Figure out who is going to listen to you. And if the first person that you share the bullying with doesn't listen, just call somebody else. You need to, don't give up, keep trying. And often by the time clinicians bring a situation to me, we have to go above people's heads because the principal wasn't even listening. The principal was dismissive. And so then we have to look at the district level. Who's in charge of pupil services? Who can we get to listen to this situation? And it helps a lot if you've been documenting what's been going on. So even if you don't have physical proof, making notes of what your child said and what the date was, and just starting to keep kind of a log of what's been going on, as well as what you have shared with the school. So getting that in writing is really helpful down the road. It's a little pessimistic to think that you have to be that way, but it's helpful.
Yeah. I always say, if it's not in writing, it didn't happen. But, and the great thing now with our smartphones, you can add notes right onto your phone. If you don't have access to, you know, a Google form or doc on your phone, but you have little notes pirate, or you can message yourself. So there are ways to track that. But I loved what you said in terms of just slowing down in the beginning. And that's incredibly important, so that our kids feel seen, they feel heard, and knowing that you're going to walk through this with them and get the supports and resources, even if you don't have those immediate answers when they bring this information home to you, or, you know, through that kind of asking and statements in the beginning that we were talking about, that it's starting to come to light, but just kind of slowing down, get the information, and then making that action plan.
And the reason that's so important, this is one of the best ways to reduce trauma, actually. So when we look at what makes kids resilient or sort of protects them from feeling trauma, it's this kind of supportive relationship with a caring adult. And also, I think it's important for us to empower the child. So bullying is very disempowering. It's a feeling of helplessness because we can't seem to make it stop. We can't make this peer stop treating us this way. And so if a parent really has some kind of a fast, strong reaction and goes up to the school and starts yelling at everybody, that's not empowering the child, you know? And I think what's hardest about this sometimes is your child may not want you to do anything. And, you know, you have to gather all the information and see whether you need to actually show them that there are things that can be done that will not embarrass them or put them at greater risk. But sometimes, and in some schools, our advice has to be, you know, unless it's going to be physically safe for you to do something or say something about this, there are times when it is best to kind of keep your head down. And I'm talking about, you know, schools where the behavior is really, really rough, you know, not your typical, hopefully, experience. But my point with that was just there are times when the most important thing to do is to honor your child's wishes about how it's handled.
As we kind of wind down our conversation today, what is something that I didn't know enough to ask that I should have asked?
I think we've covered a lot of good topics. One thing that I like to encourage parents to think about is whether they are teaching their kids good social problem solving. So I think this is sort of an area for any parent to be thinking about with their kids. And a lot of kids just develop this ability naturally, but if your child hasn't, it's really good to do it more explicitly. And so I think teaching them social brainstorming, we're going to sit down, talk about this situation, and write down all of the possible ways that you could respond. And then let's look at which ones actually might help the situation, which ones might make the situation worse. And so just really realizing that sometimes our kids need us to be therapists in this way and kind of. It may feel artificial, but it doesn't need to. You know, I think it can be kind of fun, especially if it's a judgment-free zone and we're just brainstorming and then sort of exploring these options. And it's a chance for you to gain some insight into your child's own social abilities and realize how much scaffolding they may need. So I think just encouraging parents to be really active in this area will help then when the child maybe comes home with a bad experience that they've had. So just having that prevention mindset and trying to work these kinds of conversations into your everyday lives.
Yeah. Driving's always a good one.
Yeah.
When you're driving somewhere to kind of start having those dialogues and starting the conversations early, I would imagine as well, right? And kind of helping to navigate when they're little, helping your kiddo build those skills. And then especially before these big transition years, whether it's into elementary or middle school or high school or wherever, and really kind of ensuring that they have a skill set to the best of their capacity as well. Well, this has been such a helpful conversation. I hope parents have learned a lot. I know that you're going to give me some links we're going to put in the show notes so that folks can find additional resources. I always end my podcast with one final question, and that is, if you had a billboard for parents with a tip, what would it be and why?
I would say probably the thing I wind up encouraging the most is ask the school to do more. That's not a catchy phrase, but I get concerned how many parents are struggling at home with thinking they need to help their kids handle everything, when in fact the school should be helping you more. And that is definitely the case with bullying. So yeah, ask more of your school.
I love it. I love it. We will shout that on the billboard for sure. So Dr. Wanders, Christine, this has been a great, helpful discussion, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you so, so much.
You're welcome. I really enjoyed it as well.
You bet. Thanks for tuning in to the Special Ed Strategist. Remember, the right support can make all the difference. As your dedicated Special Ed Strategist, I'm here to guide, collaborate, and empower your kiddos' success. Keep igniting potential one step at a time. Until next time, take care and keep strategizing. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com.